With regard to recruiting, we have a great economy, and I would not trade in a great economy for one more soldier. But that means we have to operate more innovatively.
In visits to Anchorage, military officials say recruitment is tough, even with higher defense spending. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 10th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, farmers are confident they can make industrial hemp work in Alaska despite weather constraints.
I think agriculturalists and Alaskans in general, when you tell them you can't do something, we find ways to make it happen.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
High-ranking military officials are visiting Alaska this week, part of the annual pilgrimage by federal officials and cabinet members during the August recess. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports that even though national defense spending is up, different services are still facing major recruitment challenges.
It was a little chaotic inside a giant hangar at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson when head of the Air Force, Heather Wilson, dropped by. There were pilots on hand to greet the secretary, a knot of reporters, officers, and Secret Service personnel. Airplanes roared overhead, and then there were several dozen paratroopers in camouflage face paint, loaded down with parachutes, giving occasional chants as they waited to pile into cargo planes for practice jumps. Wilson is in Alaska for the first time since taking over as Secretary of the Air Force 15 months ago. She's visiting J-Bear and interior bases to get a sense of how Air Force members in the 49th state are doing and what is needed. The most recently passed National Defense Authorization Act budgets more money for personnel, but the Air Force is having a hard time recruiting and retaining service members. That's especially true of pilots who have been leaving the service for lucrative jobs in the commercial sector. Wilson says the Air Force has to do a better job of incentivizing highly trained flyers.
But we also have to increase the number of pilots that we're training. So we're expanding pilot training.
One reason military officials make visits like this is to get out of the Capitol to hear more directly from troops and commanders. Lieutenant General Kenneth Wilsbach is the highest-ranking officer in Alaska and says one of his requests to the secretary is to lessen the administrative burden on troops.
And she's actually a big advocate for this, is reducing the amount of bureaucracy for the average airman. So things that don't make a readiness difference, let's reduce those things to give the airmen more time to do mission, to give them more time with their families.
Just a day earlier, Army Secretary Mark Esper spoke to the local press alongside Senator Dan Sullivan after meeting with military families at J-Bear and Fort Wainwright. The Army is trying to expand its ranks after years of reductions under the Obama administration, with an ambitious aim to add 30,000 active duty troops in less than a decade, increasing the overall size to more than 500,000 before 2028. But Esper says it's not an easy time to convince people to enlist.
With regard to recruiting, we have a great economy, and I would not trade in a great economy for one more soldier. But that means we have to operate more innovatively.
One area where the military has been shedding personnel is immigrants with particular skill sets who joined the service under a program called Military Accessions for Vital National Interest, or MAVNI. The initiative started in 2008 under the Office of the Secretary of Defense in order to draw in immigrants who spoke strategically important languages or had professional training in fields like medicine, and in exchange, put them on an expedited path to citizenship. MAVNI ran into bureaucratic hurdles in 2014, and more recently under the Trump administration, troops were being discharged from the Army without explanation. On Thursday, several national news outlets reported the Army had ordered a halt to those discharges while it evaluated the separation process. Esper says the halt to the MAVNI program won't affect end-strength numbers and cites potential security concerns in some immigrants' backgrounds as a reason not to restart it.
MAVNIs, by definition of the name itself, are those persons who may present a skill that's vital to the national interest. But at the same time, we have to place importance on the security of these folks to make sure that we understand what we are accessing into our force.
The heads of the Navy and the Coast Guard are also stopping in Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Three visitors to Katmai National Park could face charges after approaching feeding brown bears yesterday evening. Two Alaska residents and one out-of-state visitor entered a closed area below Brooks Falls and approached multiple bears. Viewers watching the park's live bear cam saw a man wade into the water below the falls and take a selfie in front of a group of grizzlies lunging for salmon. It's illegal in Katmai National Park to come within 50 yards of a bear while it's using a concentrated food source. The Park Service closes the area around Brooks Falls from June 15th to August 15th to reduce negative bear-human interactions and to allow bears stocking up on salmon ahead of winter hibernation to eat in peace. Visitors can view the bears from elevated platforms at Brooks Camp. Multiple bear cam viewers and visitors expressed concern to park rangers about the violation. Park rangers then contacted the three visitors, and charges are currently pending. Once charges are finalized, the Park Service will release details about their identities. No visitors or bears were injured. Independent Elise Galvin reported contributions of nearly $65,000 for her U.S. House bid in July, more than the incumbent Republican U.S. Representative Don Young. Young, however, retained a large edge in available cash at the end of the reporting period August 1st with nearly $435,000. He reported contributions of about $28,800 in July. Most of his contributions were from out-of-state political action committees. Galvin is seeking the Democratic nomination in the August 21st primary. She and Democrat Dimitri Shane have run the most active campaigns on that side. Shane's latest fundraising filing wasn't immediately available. Galvin reported having just over $250,000 on hand. Young is the longest-serving member of the House. His primary opponents reported little or no fundraising. A major decision for the proposed Donlin mine is expected Monday. That's when the Army Corps of Engineers is set to roll out its record of decision after years of review. As Christy Schallenberger with Alaska's Energy Desk reports, it'll be a major milestone in the development of what could be one of the biggest gold mines in the world, if it's approved.
It's like Christmas Eve for Donlin Gold.
We're excited. This is a major milestone for the project moving forward.
That's Kurt Parkin, the spokesman for Donlin. The company is trying to develop one of the biggest gold mines in the world in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and they need at least 100 permits before they can start mining. And some of those permits could come as part of a joint record of decision from the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Land Management on Monday. Donlin is pretty confident the project will be approved.
Projects go into the process of getting a permit with the expectation that they will get a permit.
The joint record of decision is a big deal because it's the end of a six-year review process. Throughout those years, Donlin, federal and state agencies, and other stakeholders have worked together to determine how the project would impact the land and the water surrounding it. And all that information is put into a document called the Environmental Impact Statement. Donlin's final EIS came out earlier this year, and because the mine would impact thousands of acres of wetlands and include a gas pipeline that runs through BLM land, both agencies have to issue permits. Army Corps spokesman John Budnick says that the record of decision does not mean that Donlin will have the permits in hand on Monday, but it does show how the agencies think the mine should move forward. The actual permits could come a couple of months later. However, nearly a dozen tribes have issued anti-Donlin resolutions in the past 2 months. They fear that the mine could impact their subsistence way of life, which is practiced by the majority of the YK Delta residents. And they fear a mine accident could contaminate the Kuskokwim River, which supplies a lot of food for the region. Meanwhile, Donlin expects to get most of its major permits out of the way this year. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
The Alaska Fire Service is floating a plan to contract with Alaska Native corporations and tribal groups to provide wildfire crews. AFS spokeswoman Beth Ipson says the draft proposal currently out for potential contractors to provide feedback on has several potential advantages.
Give them more of an opportunity for stable employment, give them some opportunity for Native self-governance, as well as a higher quality, more experienced crew that can spend more days on a fire assignment.
Ipson says emergency firefighting crews across Alaska have declined from 70 to 20 over the last 15 years, a drop attributed to other more stable employment opportunities and increasing government regulations, including a health screening.
The contractor could potentially have some requirements like physical requirements, physical fitness requirements or medical requirements, but that would be up to the contractor.
Ipsen says AFS emergency fire crews work an average of 16 days per summer, but contract crews could get additional work outside of firefighting, including through federal grants contractors can apply for.
There could be fuels mitigation projects. There could be other project work, say, in the villages where they're located. So it opens it up for more consistent work outside of just the emergency call-up as-needed basis.
Ipsen adds that having more crews located across the AFS rural northern Alaska service area would make for quicker response when local fires crop up. She says the contract proposal currently out for comment is modeled after a U.S. Forest Service program in the lower 48. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, some Native organizations say the Interior Department is keeping quiet about the land trust program review.
They've given us no real indication of what they're doing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnosis and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Hemp is technically the same type of plant as marijuana, but it can't get you high. So it's surprising that as Alaska's recreational marijuana industry has bloomed, hemp production is still only on the path to becoming a legal, regulated industry. That could change by 2019, according to the head of a new industrial hemp pilot program. There's overwhelming interest in the program, but with its cold soils and long summer days, is Alaska a good fit for a hemp industry? Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry has more.
There we go. Now you got some light.
Rob Carter pulls open a garage door and light floods a warehouse full of wooden and plastic bins. He pops open the top of one and scoops up a handful of golden-colored seed.
It's pretty amazing to see Alaska-grown wheat. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, wheat can't be grown. It's like, no, it can be grown and it is grown. It's grown commercially. It's grown on a small scale.
Carter is the managing agronomist for the Alaska Plant Materials Center outside of Palmer. The 400-acre experiment farm and seed cleaning facility is the epicenter of a soon-to-be industrial hemp pilot program that will enlist hemp growers from all over the state. Carter says he gets 1 to 2 calls a day from people interested in participating.
It's kind of the gold rush thing. Like, a lot of people want to come in and it's new and they want to be a participant.
Hemp is used in a bunch of different ways. To feed livestock, for medicinal purposes. It's even used by the oil industry to fill cracks and fissures in the earth caused by drilling. Carter says he sees a lot of possibility from hemp-based oils like CBD. The cannabinoid is used to treat everything from epilepsy to inflammation. Right now, the federal government doesn't regulate it, and a tiny bottle can cost over $100 online.
And so you go to the natural health food store or the gas station, and you find this CBD product, and you consume it. Well, you tell me what's in it. You don't know.
Carter wants to design a pilot program that would increase transparency and more tightly regulate the growth of hemp and extraction of CBDs. He thinks Alaskan-grown hemp could offer something other places can't.
We have relatively clean soils and very clean water and an unbelievably clean growing environment. I think that we have the opportunity to build a program that can be some of the cleanest industrial hemp anywhere in the world.
Carter is clearly optimistic about the hemp industry in Alaska, but that's not based off of hard evidence. It was illegal to grow in the U.S., even for research purposes, for more than 75 years. Then Congress authorized state-sponsored industrial hemp pilot programs in the 2014 Farm Bill. Alaska joined more than 30 other states when it legalized a program earlier this year. Despite the lack of hard evidence, Carter thinks a permanent industrial hemp industry is viable here. He says whether illegal or legal, producers have been growing cannabis indoors and outdoors in Alaska for a long time, and similar climates like Northern Europe have made it work.
I think agriculturalists and Alaskans in general, when you tell them you can't do something, we find ways to make it happen.
Still, determination can only get you so far. Most strains of hemp need warm soils for their deep root systems and a period of darkness each day to flower and produce seeds. Alaskan summers offer neither. That's why University of Alaska Fairbanks agronomist Bob Van Veldhuizen has his doubts about the industry. He thinks hemp would need to be grown indoors or in high tunnels, which is expensive. He's not against legalization, but...
I'm sure that somebody somewhere would be able to do it, but the likelihood of this becoming, you know, a major viable crop for Alaska at this point seems to be pretty small.
Ember Haynes is a Talkeetna-based farmer and hemp product producer. She thinks that there are some varieties of the plant that will grow well here. She hopes to participate in the pilot program and grow hemp on a small scale to feed her animals and use for her lotions and balms.
I look at hemp, especially in Alaska, as being a grassroots movement, that it does not have to start with big agriculture, that it can start, you know, on the small scales.
And Haynes isn't alone. Rob Carter says he's seen such an overwhelming interest in the pilot program that it's taking longer than expected to draft program regulations. After the regulations go up for public comment, they'll open applications. Carter says the more people that participate, the stronger the industry will become. In Anchorage, I'm Erin McKinstry.
The Department of the Interior is reviewing Alaska tribes' ability to put land into trust, a right available to these tribes only since 2014. The Interior Department is holding consultations across the state to get feedback on the land trust program. A consultation was Friday afternoon at the Ketchikan Public Library. As KRBD's Liam Niemeyer reports, many local tribal organizations see the Interior Department's actions as an encroachment on their rights.
In 2014, Alaska tribes won a lawsuit against the Department of the Interior for the right to put land into trust, expelling the Alaska exemption. Land into trust is a process in which tribal organizations can request specific land to be exempted from taxation and local zoning laws, and protected from proceedings such as eminent domain or foreclosure. It essentially keeps the land in tribal ownership permanently. DOI officials are talking with tribes across the state in a series of consultations this summer to reconsider land trust rules in Alaska. Matthew Newman, an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund representing the village of Saxman, was one of many people who attended the latest consultation at the Ketchikan Public Library. He says DOI has not been clear with the purpose of these consultations.
They've given us no real indication of what they're doing. I, as an attorney, as well as my clients, you know, we received letters in the mail on the 2nd of July, just showed up saying we're reconsidering the program.
Newman says many tribal leaders at the consultation perceive these meetings as an attack on their rights that they won just recently. Only the Craig Tribal Association has been able to put land into trust since the 2014 decision. The association put about 1 acre containing the city's town hall and offices into trust in early 2017. Craig Tribal Association President Clinton Cook Sr. says one of the reasons land trust rules should remain in place is their association has proven it can work in Alaska.
So that we knew there was going to be hurdles to come across. We overcame that hurdle. We're very, very proud of our accomplishment, and we look forward to other tribes in Alaska to be able to put lands into trust.
Jacqueline Pita from Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska also attended the Ketchikan consultation. She says, like many tribes in the lower 48 who have been able to put land into trust for decades, tribes in Alaska and Southeast simply want to protect their land for the future.
These are our lands. We don't want to lose them from alienation of any form. We want them to be identified as tribal lands, and that as we move forward in the future, they will be protected for future generations.
Peta says she hopes DOI will take this feedback and maintain the land trust program throughout Alaska. Until that decision, she says it is a waiting game to see what DOI does with this feedback. In Ketchikan, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings.
K
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, can you dig it? Every summer, the Aleutic Museum and Archaeological Repository hosts a project in Kodiak where students and community members can join in. This season, they're excavating a site on a small island which appears to have been a subsistence camp from thousands of years ago. KMXT's Daisha Eaton has more.
Down a trail through stands of towering Sitka spruce across a rocky beach and along an outcropping is a freshly dug 4x5 patch of dirt where researchers believe that thousands of years ago, Aleutic people once caught and smoked cod.
So we're at the archaeological site called Kiktangjuk.
That means little island in Aleutic. And that's Molly O'Dell, who's a project manager and archaeologist at the museum. It's day three of community archaeology, and through the filtered light of an alder canopy, the all-volunteer team of 10 is uncovering a large fire pit about 3 meters across. Initial discoveries point to the site being a seasonal camp.
We haven't found any evidence of houses or people living here, so it probably was more like a camp.
And like a fish camp.
Yep. And Patrick, my colleague, was out here hiking one time, and he saw some people catching cod right from the beach, and this was just a few years ago. So we know that you can catch cod here today, so you probably could a few thousand years ago as well.
They've already dug up a fist-sized rock fishing line weight called a plummet, which indicates the site could be around 3,000 years old. Patrick Saltonstall is curator of archaeology at the Aleutic Museum.
Archaeology is all about using evidence to come up with what happened in the past. The story is what really matters.
As he explains, a big part of figuring out the story comes from mapping the site.
106, 113, 110.
It's the elevation in relation to data. So we'll be able to make a three-dimensional map of the site.
Peter Ellis is a PhD student in archaeology at the University of Pittsburgh who traveled all the way to Kodiak to volunteer on the project.
I've never dug anything this old before. This is very cool to me. Again, back in the East Coast, everything was, you know, 1700s, 1800s for me. Oldest is probably, you know, 1400, you know, AD. So this is kind of a really cool and unique opportunity. I've never seen a feature like a smoke processing pit that size either before.
He worked on another community archaeology dig in Dutch Harbor in the Aleutian Islands last summer, and he's an experienced digger who says the way you dig matters.
So basically, you know, with archaeology, we're looking at time as it goes down through the soil. So you want to dig mostly horizontally, thin layers at a time. So if you look for any changes, you might find them by digging horizontally and slowly instead of kind of digging, you know, one deep, quick pit straight down. So that's where we use the trowels and the dustpans to slowly scoop dirt into our dustpans and put them in the bucket, and then we give them to our screener, who's going to run all that sediment through a screen to catch any artifacts bigger than a quarter inch or a half inch.
The very first day of the dig, volunteer Keith Bruce, a sophomore at Kodiak High School, found the artifact mentioned earlier, the fishing weight.
The first day I found a stone plummet, which was used to hold down fishing line. It was a weird feeling, you know. You're touching something someone touched 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago. It feels special because you can see where someone's hit it, spent time knocking around, making the groove.
In between, it's a lot of digging until that magical moment when your eye spots something.
Okay, what are you finding here, Molly?
I'm starting to find soil that has little tiny white flecks in it, which I think are degraded shells. Like clamshells, things like that. And then I found some little tiny pieces of fishbone here, which is what we were hoping to find because we were thinking this was a smoking pit for fish.
And then the crew finds something else, another plummet.
A line weight or a net weight. It's a notched, a rock here that looks kind of ugly, but it's notched on either end. And this is probably would have had a line around it and would have held a rig for fishing on the bottom. So they could, this is how they caught the cod that they fished in within here.
Another clue that hopefully, when added together with all the others, will create a small window into the world of Aleutic people in Kodiak thousands of years ago. In Kodiak, I'm Daisha Eaton with help from Zane Navarro.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Ralph Watkins in Hoonah. Watkins is the superintendent of Hoonah City Schools and was involved in the annual Kuik Festival, which celebrates the city's Tlingit culture and heritage.
This is my third Kuik, and each time it's equally as moving for me. And I think for me, as an African American, it's even more so. Here's a group of people who were displaced from their home, but they brought their culture with them. And then some people came and tried to rip that away from them and suppress it. And they were a subjugated group of people, maligned, disenfranchised, cut off from the greater society and their own culture. I know absolutely nothing about my African history. Nothing. I don't know where I come from. I'm from Compton, but I mean, you know what I mean? I don't know where I come from. I don't know who my people are. I don't know any of that. You know, I'm almost jealous. And so the fact that I can be a part of preserving something that I couldn't do for my own culture is important to me. It almost makes me cry every time. I made a concerted, deliberate effort to be a part of the community. And that to me was the big piece. That effort, and it's paid dividends because now people see me as a part of the community. We greet each other when we go to the store, when we see each other at the dock, whatever we're doing. I mean, it's just, I feel like I am a part of Hoonah.
Ralph Watkins lives in Hoonah. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Daisha Eaton, Adeline Baxter, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. Also, the Alaska's Energy Desk podcast Midnight Oil has restarted for season 2. That, just like Alaska News Nightly, is available wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, Aaron McKinstry in Palmer, and Liam Niemeyer in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is David Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.